Pod Clubhouse.
Each year, we're inundated with thousands of hours of television, hundreds of movies, new music every week. It can be overwhelming. How do you know what's worth your time and what you should just skip? Lucky for you, Pod Clubhouse is here to help. I'm Mike from Pop Culture Review, and this is Love It or Leave It, the podcast. Tonight on Love It or Leave It, joining me to discuss Amazon's new show, Hunters, is Tony Carini, a up-and-coming New York City comic, and Sheila McGann, an associate writer over at Pop Culture Review with me. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, Mike. Thanks for having us on.
Great, Mike. Thanks for having us.
I went with your pop culture careers versus your day jobs.
I appreciate that.
Tony is an international spy by trade.
Thanks for pulling my cover. I appreciate that.
Well, that's not your real name, so we're good.
His real name is Anthony. Hunters is based loosely on Tony's life, actually. He is actually a 97-year-old Jewish man. You are in for a ride and some hot takes tonight, people.
Well, just like Pacino, I'm an Italian man playing a Jewish man. So it's really great. It's awesome.
How are you guys making out with being in self-isolation in a time of coronavirus?
Doing okay. Trying to maintain a level of normalcy.
Oh, please. Kid, so. I've seen your posts, Sheila. Come on, talk about the homeschooling.
Homeschooling. Yeah, like, seriously, am I getting a second paycheck this week? Because, you know, it's been challenging.
I work from home anyway, so the adjustment has been my wife being around way more than I'm used to. And then I don't have kids. I have my parents, and they're like worse than children because they should know better, but they don't.
They all want to go outside.
That's just the thing. I mean, like last week, you know, because it was Lent and my brother was coming over. My mother goes, Anthony, go to the store to pick up some food. I'm like, but there's a virus thing going on. And so she sends me to the store to pick up lobster because she figured nobody would have bought the lobster because they spent all their money on toilet paper. And damn it, we had lobster that night. So she was smart.
Well, that's pretty good. I cooked up a storm, so we've been eating leftovers for a week. I'm getting sick of it. So I'm going to be cooking again tomorrow, so we'll be sick of it next week, too.
I raided the bones of what was left of ShopRite, actually, earlier today, and then on my way home, bought a pizza, and that's what I had for dinner. So why did I even bother going to ShopRite? I don't know. I figure I'll have pizza for a couple extra days. Separate from coronavirus, I think all three of us were also sadly affected by the passing of Kenny Rogers today. What a bummer.
I'm very sad because The Gambler was a very big part of my college career. I went to school in Australia, so for some reason, 80s U.S. country music was a big thing there, and The Gambler was like the staple at karaoke. So I had to check in on some friends today, make sure that they were doing okay.
So for me, it's one of those things that my dad raised me on, that kind of music. And so when I saw it this morning, my first reaction was like, oh God, please don't tell me it was coronavirus. So it's actually like, yes, he died in his sleep or natural causes. I'm like, okay, there's that. I got to see him live about two or three years ago. Came to tour here in Jersey, Christmas time. And I got to tell you, it was a blast. He just had his hip replaced, so he had to sit down. But he sung all the hits, and then he sung a bunch of Christmas music too. And it was so much fun. So I was bummed. So we were definitely playing, and I'm not kidding here, we were definitely playing Kenny Rogers music today in the house.
I count The Gambler probably among my top 25 songs.
So he dies in the end, right? Like, The Gambler dies, right, in the song? Are we all agreeing on that?
Okay. And he dies in his sleep. So, just, you know, The Gambler, he broke even. So, you know, it's kind of fortuitous that Kenny Rogers, too.
That is very well put, Sheila.
Yes. Well, I'm trying for poetry here.
If this was Family Guy, Peter would turn to the camera and say, he really did break even in the end. So. But we're not here to talk about coronavirus, guys, and we are not here to talk, or Kenny Rogers. We are here to talk about Amazon's new series. It's one of their newest. It came out on February 21st. It is called Hunters. It is a 10-episode series created by David Weil. You guys may be asking yourself, who is David Weil? Have you ever heard of this guy before?
No.
No, because this is his first writing credit. He's did a couple small acting roles over the years. He's got some like indie producer credits. This is his very first writing job. And he got a massive show led by Al Pacino put on the air by Amazon. I don't know what David Weil, what kind of mojo he's working with, but God bless him being able to put together this gargantuan. This is epic peak TV, what they call prestige TV. Before we get into the nitty gritty, what did you guys think overall of Hunters?
I loved it. I was hooked from the cold open of the first episode. I mean, the first 5 minutes, just absolutely like jaw dropping. What is this? Literally over just a couple of nights, because, you know, I had to get up and go to work at ungodly hours of the morning. So I would just watch it and just, you know, can't wait for the next one. So I was downloading them on my iPad and watching them on the train. So it literally took me maybe 3 or 4 days to get through the whole series because I just couldn't wait to find out.
Hold on. You watched it on the train?
Hell yeah.
That is awesome. Like, I just want to be the guy sitting next to you going, what is she watching? Right?
So, confession, I also watched the entire Game of Thrones series because I was a late adopter to Game of Thrones. So I watched the entire series, all 6 seasons until the 7th season came out on the train. So Game of Thrones is a little bit different to watch than Hunters. I mean, Hunters just has some, you know, gory violence, not a ton of sex like Game of Thrones. Yeah, the person sitting next to me for Game of Thrones was probably a little bit more entertained.
I applaud you, by the way, because that's awesome. We have a big giant window in my home. Where we haven't gotten a curtain yet, we're actually going to be installing shutters too, because every time I'm watching TV and if anything comes up with graphic nudity on it, I have to look around and behind my back and see if my neighbor's checking it out, you know? So uncomfortable.
Which they totally are.
They totally are. It's just, it really...
I know people.
they sit there. I mean, Tony, you do interpretive dance in front of that window. We all know. We all come and watch. So
I mean, you think they get used to it. My wife walks topless in front of the window anyway. So, I mean, do you think they just get used to it by now? You know what I'm saying? So, but whatever. So they could be bummed when the new shutters come in. Let me just be right up front. I saw the trailer and I'm going, holy shit, this is going to be amazing. I'm like, yeah, Pacino. And I'm excited about that because he's definitely had a bit of a resurgence with The Irishman and all that. And his role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was great. I just thought the premise was really, really cool. I talked to my wife about it. And I'm like, hey, look, I want to watch a show. Do you want to come along for the ride? She agreed, which is so much easier when your partner wants to watch the show too. We got sucked in. And Sheila, you're right. The first 5 minutes, I'm going to argue, is possibly the best intro to a show I have ever experienced. Come at me. What do you think?
I completely agree. I couldn't remember another sort of open to a show that was just so gripping. I mean, seriously, like, you're just like, what is going on here? And just, you're blown away. Also saw a trailer, actually a commercial during the Super Bowl. Nobody else was really paying attention because everybody was watching J-Lo and Shakira, but I saw this commercial for Hunters. You know, I was just really intrigued by it, and I did some looking around on Amazon and saw the other trailers that they had, and there was one that was released, I think, sometime in January. They had just a little bit of different content, and I was like, oh, absolutely, this is something I'm going to tune into the week it comes out.
Same with me. I was sold when I got the screeners popped in for this. I was super excited because it was high on my list. I think I was motivated more by the premise than even Al Pacino. I feel like Al Pacino has had an interesting arc the last 20 years or so. So I was a little wary of him, honestly, you know, another big name celebrity coming to TV. So he wasn't a big draw for me. It was really the premise, the setting. Anyone that does late 70s or early 1980s New York City, you're pretty much going to get me hooked. I love gritty New York, and the idea of kind of Nazi hunting really just appealed to me. I mean, it's a total catharsis, revenge fantasy thing that I'm totally into. You watch the first episode, which was really long. These are long episodes to begin with, but the first episode is actually like 90 minutes. It just keeps you glued to your screen. Before we get any further, though, let's talk about what is Hunter. So if you have no idea, if you haven't paid attention, part of Love It or Leave It is to tell you about the show and why we think you should watch it or not watch it. Set in 1977, Hunters follows the story of Jonah Heidelbaum, a young man who is, you know, watching Star Wars for the first time. He is smoking dope. He is a comic book nerd. He is also Jewish. His grandmother, who he lives with, is killed in a kind of brutal murder. And it changes his life, really, because he learns that she was part of a small band of Nazi hunting assassins that are made up of Jewish Holocaust survivors, including his grandmother, flashy Jewish heartthrobs, Vietnam vets, soul sisters with Black Panther connections. It's a eclectic group. There's a Catholic nun who wears a full habit and kills Nazis like a badass. It's a eclectic group of people who come together and hunt Nazis. On the other side, you also have the Nazis themselves, given the face of Dylan Baker, who kind of plays the main Nazi that we get to see through most of the series. And the idea is that Nazis are in American government. They have been placed here. They are at NASA, the Congress, and through Operation Paperclip, which was an actual real thing in the United States, these were refugee Nazis who were brought over by the United States to work on our space program to beat the Russians in the space. And they've kind of just grabbed power here, and they're trying to establish a Fourth Reich. That's the overall premise of it. Now, before we go any further, did I miss anything? Do we need anything? And we're doing mild spoilers here, but we're not doing big spoilers. So keep that in mind, you two.
Yes, sir. You forgot to mention that Jonah was also an aspiring drug dealer, apparently, at the beginning of the show, too. Should go in to sell some marijuana and then getting his his ass handed to him.
Well, sure. I mean, he's an entrepreneur for sure. Yeah, him and he's got his posse. He's got Booty Hole and what's the other guy's name? I'm drawing a blank on it, but
Cheeks.
There you go. So they're his boys that he's rolling around New York City with. What did you guys think of the overall premise of the show?
So one of the things that I really loved, the actual introduction with the chessboard, and I saw that this was going to be an intelligence show, and that's what I liked about it. I thought the writing was definitely Tarantino inspired, without a doubt. And so since I'm a Tarantino fan as well, I liked that this was kind of going that way. So the writing and then the acting. I thought that the actors that played, you know, the main hunters was just phenomenal. I really appreciated everybody, what they brought. So, you know, you mentioned Sister Harriet. So since all three of us are, you know, graduates of Catholic school, so I was rooting for the nun. I'm like a badass nun. Who doesn't want that? That's kind of awesome, you know? But
when I grow up, I want to be Sister Harriet. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, don't interrupt. And then it was like, you mentioned Mike, you mentioned the characters. So you kind of hinted at it. Josh Radnor's character, Lonnie Fish, doing the most amazing bat mitzvah of all time. I mean, back in the day when I was DJing, that's the kind of bat mitzvah I wanted to DJ, was introduced as the dreamy hunky Jew. I mean, that's awesome. That's just simply awesome.
I was not a huge fan of How I Met Your Mother. I liked it enough.
You're still a good person, Mike. You're still a good person. I just want you to know that. Okay.
Well, here's the thing. I liked it enough. I loved, you know, Neil Patrick Harris. I'm a big Barney Stinson guy, you know, like Siegel, right? I liked the characters in the show. I despised Ted Mosby. I disliked it. And it had nothing to do with Radnor's performance. It was just a character I did not like. But then you fast forward, and then Josh Radnor gets this show a couple of years ago called Rise, where he plays a theater, like an English teacher, who's trying to get Spring Awakening put up at his high school as like their play. And I was a huge fan of that show. I loved him in that. I loved the show, and it got canceled because we can't have those kinds of shows. We can't have Spring Awakening being portrayed by high school students on broadcast television. Yeah, he was great in it, and it totally turned me around on him. And I realized, looking back now, it was really Ted Mosby that I didn't like and not Josh Radnor. So I was so excited to see him in this. Yeah, and playing Lonnie, he's the only one that's really not playing someone with like a secret identity. He is this Jewish actor who thinks his shit doesn't stink. You know, he's looking to, you know, mazzle some girls' tubs. And, but he's also killing motherfuckers at nighttime and not even wearing a mask. He's just like, yeah, I'm Lonnie Flash,
bitch.
Yeah,
he is out there as himself.
Yeah. And he's totally out there.
And wants to get recognized. I mean, he got recognized at the one point, right, when they were tailing Jonah. And I missed that, by the way, the first time. I caught it when I rewatched that scene. I was like, that's hilarious. I love the fact that he's like, hey, how you doing? Like, he loves the fact that he gets recognized.
Yeah.
Josh Radnor is maybe even among, like, the lesser known of the cast. This is a stacked cast. So you have Al Pacino, obviously a big name. Everyone knows Al Pacino. Sheila, do you have a particular Al Pacino role that you like or dislike? Because God knows there are people that also dislike some Al Pacino stuff.
I mean, I really didn't care for him in Scent of a Woman.
I'm
way too far back. I mean, it's quotable. But I mean, as far as a character, it did nothing for me. Like Devil's Advocate, I love, you know, obviously the two first two Godfathers. We don't talk about the third one in my family. Yeah, so, you know, he's kind of like fallen out of favor until, you know, the last couple of years, you know, with we mentioned with the Irishman and stuff like that. So I was on board for him.
I'm gonna go totally opposite of Sheila because I loved him in Scent of a Woman, and I think it's just that scene, right? I know he's overacting and I get it, but I actually appreciate that scene and how he just delivers every line. But I agree with the Devil's Advocate because my wife's a big Keanu Reeves fan, and now I've become one even before, you know, his resurgence with John Wick. Pacino in Devil's Advocate is just what a performance. It's just so solid. And then I agree too. It's the first two Godfathers are great, but then there's stuff out there that, like, you know, people forget, I think, like Dick Tracy. I thought he was so great in Dick Tracy because, again, over the top, it was a cartoon movie. You know, so it was
meant to be over the top.
Yeah.
Delivered. Yeah.
Oh my God, did he ever deliver?
I forgot all about that. Yeah.
Yes, because I don't know why that's not on as much as I think it could be, as far as, like, you know, on TNT and all that. I think you should definitely come around a few more times because, you know, you've got Madonna and you've got Warren Beatty, and it's just a lot of good stuff in there. But then there's even Any Given Sunday, because here's Cameron Diaz in a really cool role, and then it's just a great film with Jamie Foxx, and you got Pacino in it again, just showing up. And I'm going to mention it again, too. I really loved his over-the-top performance in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that just came out. I don't know if you guys saw it or not, but he's got a great small role in that film, too.
Yeah, I love that movie.
I think his Once Upon a Time role is really begun this resurgence of Pacino love, because I think the last 10 years or so he's done, you know, a couple of the HBO movies. Kenneth Branagh, if you guys are Harry Potter fans, he was Professor Lockhart, but he's known for his Shakespeare work. He's known for a lot of behind the scenes work. He once gave a quote about how he doesn't like to just ham it up. He likes to swim in the river of ham. It's a thing that I think really applies to Al Pacino too. And if you listen back to what you both said about him, his over-the-top roles are kind of a hallmark of his career, but there's such a fine line where you're over the top and it's just explosive and makes you pay attention to what he's doing, and it's memorable and it's quotable. And then there's over the top where you go a little too far and it just makes you roll your eyes and pray for the thing to be over as soon as humanly possible. And, you know, Pacino, you know, especially in the later years, when he entered his Scarf phase, I feel like Al Pacino's really ushered in a little too much in the river of ham. He was maybe in the ocean of ham at that point. I loved him here. I thought he was really cogent. I thought he played the campiness well, but never went too far. What'd you guys think of him specifically in this role of Meyer Offerman?
I loved him in this role just because he, you know, embodied sort of the torture that he went through in such a way that it humanized it. Like, it brought it to the forefront, and you were understanding sort of the emotions that Meyer was going through at the time. His emphaticness about what they're doing, the legacy of what they're doing, and why they're doing it, you know, it came across as very believable. And I know some people in the polarizing world of the love it or hate it aspect of this, some people loved his accent, his little Polish accent, and other people hated it. I thought it was suitable to the role. I thought it really worked, and it was believable. Like, I didn't feel like at any point, because I know some older Polish peoples, it sounded pretty accurate to me as far as that. So I think he did a good job in delivering on how a survivor would view what they're doing.
I didn't have a problem. I know that was one of the criticisms of the show, specifically talking about Pacino, was the Yiddishness of it all. It struck maybe a little played up, but he didn't sound any different than, like, if you've seen Judd Hirsch in the last 20 years, he sounded like just like Hershey does in every role he plays. And he's, like, you know, a bona fide Jew. So that didn't really bother me so much.
In this series?
Yeah. So it was so funny. I called him the Jewish version of Mr. Miyagi a bit, like the way he was training Jonah. But I had no problem with Pacino playing this role. I thought his accent was on. Think about it, you know, so I'm Italian-American, and so here's an Italian-American playing a Jewish role. I had to go ahead and deal with Steve Martin in My Blue Heaven, which, God, I love that film, but still, Steve Martin playing an Italian mobster, okay?
And then I was just about to say, if you say anything bad about My Blue Heaven, no. It's going to be on.
Listen, if you want to mambo anytime, I'm in, but that's not the point. The point is, here's a guy playing an Italian, right? And then you got, you know, J-Lo playing a Sicilian in The Wedding Planner. So I have no problem, again, with that. So I thought Pacino, like, I felt him wanting to turn on a bit of that, what we saw in A Scent of a Woman and Devil's Advocate, right, to go full Pacino. But I felt like he reined it in at the right moments. Did you guys feel that?
I fully expected at some point there was going to be like a Scarface kind of like blow up. And he was pretty restrained, I have to say. Like, yes, there was moments of kind of over the top feelings. I bought him as a recovering Auschwitz survivor.
This was peak Pacino for me. This was him doing what I love best about his roles, going back to The Godfather, or really, you know, even like Godfather 2, or, you know, Sheila mentioned Godfather Part 3. I mean, the idea of just when I'm out, they pull me back in. That's really kind of Jonah's story in this, is, you know, he doesn't really sure he wants to be a Nazi hunter, and he just kind of keeps getting sucked back in. I thought Pacino here really walked the fine line of, he would take it up, he would ramp it up, you know, the this is your birthright, this is righteous what we do. And just when you think, all right, here comes out a scarf and he's going to start, you know, screaming, and his eyes are going to bulge, no one's going to know what he's doing, he pulled it back in and he reined it in. And the memory, the pain that he's lived with at this point for 30 plus years of being a survivor, I felt pulsing through him, but never overtook the performance. So it was as good as Pacino ever gets, which is pretty damn good.
Yeah, it was believable for me in the sense that, like, this would be an Auschwitz survivor 30 years on, with, like, the measured sort of response to sort of the indignation that Joan is feeling, kind of coming at this where he's at in the place on the timeline. He's brand new to it and doesn't know anything about it. He's just finding out about it after this traumatic experience with his Sofda, which we'll get to. In terms of, like, you know, he has that, like what you said, the scarf, he's able to dial it back, whereas, like, you know, you've matured. You're hoping that, you know, after 30 years, you've kind of gotten some sort of, not closure, because you're never going to get closure on something like that, but at least a perspective where you can sort of operate in a more even-keeled kind of a way. I think he did a really good job playing this role.
Al Pacino playing Meyer Offerman is the benefactor whose money makes this small band of Nazi hunting assassins run, but he's much more of a Jewish Yoda in this story than, it's not really Meyer's story as much as he's a Jewish Yoda to Jonah Heidelbaum, who is played in this movie by Logan Lerman. So this is really Logan Lerman's kind of star turn. I didn't remember him really, and then when I looked at his IMDb, I realized I only really know him from the Percy Jackson movies.
Percy Jackson, yeah.
Decade ago, and I was like, oh yeah, I like those movies a lot, but I didn't put together his name. He's certainly not name recognition. What did you guys think of Logan's performance in this?
I'm a total nerd, so I completely knew that he was Percy Jackson because I read the books, and I was really hoping for the films to be better. But I thought his role was really good. I mean, he is playing someone who goes into this not knowing any of it. And I thought he played it really well. I mean, there's so much love there for his grandmother that he would literally start selling drugs just to put money on the table. And that's something he says in the first episode, right? He really sold it well. And then when he becomes conflicted, not knowing if he wants to join the hunters and be part of that, I think his emotion really comes through. I honestly, and we could talk about this, I didn't see a weak link in the cast. I mean, the fact that you've got Carol Kane there as well and others, and we'll get to them. Logan really did well when he's among these senior actors like Pacino, like Carol Kane, you know, and then like Lena Olin as well. And I thought he held his own.
He for sure held his own, much like David Wilde, this being his first writing credit. It's interesting that they picked a relatively unknown or untested young actor to carry such a large show. And this is a large ensemble. It has got a stellar cast. But then you have this, you know, relatively young, inexperienced actor carrying this heavy role. And I gotta tell you, I think he has probably one of the best emotional arcs in the show, too. I think the characters are all very enjoyable. I think Al Pacino's Meyer has some fleshed out depth to him. Carol Kane and Saul Rubinick's characters, you know, Mindy and Murray, they get some emotional depth and get drawn out as the series goes on. But largely, it's really only, it's Logan's character, Jonah, who really gets the full treatment. I understand who he is. You know, I see I see his conflict. I see him wrestling with it. I felt like I knew him as a real person every successive episode, which is, for me, a sign of great TV, is that when I can get emotionally invested in the character and be brought along with his journey, and I feel like he goes on a journey, for me, that's a sign of great television.
Again, I really only knew him from the Percy Jackson series, and that was, you know, going on a decade ago. To kind of see him in with the, you know, the Al Pacinos, the Carol Kane, Saul Rubinick, like all of these people who've, you know, had their storied careers, and he's just kind of plunked in the middle of them. I think he really held his own with them, sort of just really made the scene about, like you said, about his journey, where he's going, and he's taking from them what he needs in order to keep moving forward. You know, as a character and as an actor, I think he just really worked. You know, he's very easy to read. Like you can see what he's going through on his face. You know, you touched on, you know, Carol Kane, the Mindy and Murray, the Markowitzes. I have to say those two really put me through sort of the emotional gamut, you know, back and forth. But, you know, yeah, to bring Logan in and, you know, have him really shine in this, and he's able to carry scenes with these legendary people, is really just, you know, sort of great casting, in my opinion.
I'm glad you mentioned Carol and Saul Rubinick. All said and done, I think they're actually my favorite two characters on the show. I'm a huge Saul Rubinick fan. I was a big fan of Warehouse 13, and now he's on this. And then he actually was just on Schitt's Creek a couple weeks ago, too. So, and Carol Kane, you know, I go back to her from, like, Princess Bride. You know, I'm not a wife. I'm not a witch. I'm your wife.
And she's in My Blue Heaven, second reference.
Nice. And so am I the only one that every time Carol Kane came on the screen just started shouting, have fun storming the Nazis? I mean, because am I the yeah, am I? Okay, because I kept doing that every time.
Yeah. More recently, I love her in Princess Bride. But more recently, I loved her as the kind of dementia-ridden mother to Oswald Cobblepot in Gotham. If you any comic book TV nerds out there, she played the Penguin's mother for like a season or two. Carol Kane, you know, is classic. And I just liked that these two, the Markowitzes, they were on their own journey in the show. They weren't badasses bringing guns and killing people with like panache. They're confronting the horrors of Auschwitz's survivors, the loss of their child, you know, because of the concentration camps. They're on their own emotional journey, separate from Logan's, but they're all kind of moving forward together. The two of them together made a great pair, and I really, really enjoyed them.
And there was just such a mutual support amongst this cast. You know, the Markowitzes are experiencing sort of the other end of that spectrum. They lost a child, and then they have their daughter's wedding to come up with. And so, you know, the cast really supports them in ways that you don't expect until you kind of learn all of the facets of their journey. You know, like you mentioned, like the badass sister, like she gives them advice at different times, and it's completely badass nunnery. No nun that I know would ever, you know, kind of give the advice that Sister Harriet gives, but you know, she's got some good life lessons to share there. So
that's a great point, because I think I want to open the floor to you guys to, this is your time to shout out any of the other good guys on the good side, on the quote-unquote good side of the ledger. Who here really stood out for you, who you wouldn't mind watching maybe a spin-off series of their own, other than who we've talked about so far?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt it'd be Joe, the soldier from Vietnam. I mean, I think his backstory would be really interesting. We got a little bit of a taste of it during the show, but I think he's really, really interesting, because he was the quiet one, but he was definitely the biggest badass, I feel, because he's a soldier. He took orders, and he was really, really fun to watch, the way he executed everything.
He was great too, because he was a soldier, he executed, he was a total badass, but he also was dealing with this really simmering PTSD.
Yeah.
And I don't think they draw him out as maybe as much as the main characters in the show, but I think you got a really good feel for this guy, that he's dealing with some serious demons, that being a Nazi hunter is as much about trying to excise the painful memories from the war as anything else.
And not giving anything away, but if season two happens, I think we're going to see a lot about Joe's story. So
yeah,
that was the other part of, you know, the episode 10 moment where I was just like, oh my god, I need, where's season two? Just need it.
We're not going to get into spoilers here, but if, nope. You know, the price of admission is fully paid in episode 10. You'll be sucked in pretty much from the word go in episode 1, but episode 10 throws several plot twists. It sets up a insane season 2 on a couple different fronts. Like any good show, you can't just have good guys, you have to have some bad guys. And for me, Dylan Baker plays bad guy better than maybe anyone on television. There's something about his face that I find so watchable, and yet I don't trust a fucking thing he ever says. I always think he's trying to kill me or someone I love. That's just his like persona. And I love it so, so much. I know him from The Americans, really, but he's an ultimate, hey, it's that guy. You look at his credits, he's been on everything in some kind of guest starring role. Here he plays Bip Simpson, who, you know, in the first, I think the first episode, shoots dead a large amount of people without blinking an eye. He is a Nazi hiding in the upper echelon of America. What did you guys think about Dylan Baker's turn here and any other bad guys that really popped out to you?
Dear God, the body count in the first 5 minutes. All because of Dylan Baker's character, Biff. So we'll go back to that cold open, because that's where we get our first bad guy introduction. His eyes, when they zoom in, so this had like a very Inglourious Basterds kind of appeal to me. I know we talked about like the Quentin Tarantino-esqueness of this series and how it was kind of filmed. For me, this had a very Inglourious Basterds kind of a feeling. It was very close up. You saw a lot of, I mean, his eyes were red. His eyes were like bloodshot red, and he just looked like the devil incarnate to me. In terms of a bad guy, Dylan Baker, he just nailed it for me. And like I said, the first 5 minutes, I was like, I need to watch all of this.
The coloring in that scene also was so, if you guys remember the Black Hole Sun video from Soundgarden, where—
Yes!
The colors are like so amplified that it looks like you're watching someone's nightmare almost.
Yeah, like the pool was really extra blue. The sky was really extra blue.
Everything was so,
eyes were red.
Everything was so extra. And so when this horrendous violence erupts really out of nowhere, it's shocking. And I think the aesthetic, the background, the coloring has as much to do with that as anything else. It really does just fucking grab you by the shoulders and say, watch me. You can't look away.
Yeah, and so I really liked Dylan Baker's role as well. But I've got to be honest, my favorite bad guy, because what a twisted, crazy character Greg Austin played. And it was Travis Leach, the name of the character. I mean, he's in the first episode too, right? And it's interesting though, Mike, because I feel like that Travis kind of parallels Jonah, right? So Jonah's on his journey, to becoming a hunter, and Travis is on his journey to becoming a Nazi, right?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. That's a great parallel.
But what a piece of shit. I mean, can you think about, like, I honestly feel that actually, Greg Austin is more evil than Dylan in this series.
I'm just a big Dylan Baker stan, but I
mean, granted, he was a Nazi, so I get that part. But Austin is an American, and he's just obsessed. And the way that he that bowling alley scene and everything else that they do that he's part of, I mean, he's ruthless. And he's so calculating and smart. Amazing.
He's another one who's on a journey. I think the show's kind of commentary on, you may be surprised, listeners, to learn that the show has a political satire tinge to it. I know the idea of Nazi hunting may seem like it's not political. It's kind of political. And I think this show really takes aim at the modern day fascists that we see in this country. And I think he's really the face of that. The idea that hate is not very far away from us. And as far as we've progressed kind of in society, there are people like Travis out there in the world in 1977 and in 2020. It's kind of scary because he's also super charismatic. Like I said kind of about Dylan Baker, he's very watchable. He's a total piece of shit. He is a monster walking around on two legs, but he's also very, very watchable. It's almost disturbing when you're watching him do his thing and you're like into it, and then you realize, whoa. This guy is fucking evil. Like, what he's doing is horrible. And yet, like, I was leaning forward in my seat, kind of engrossed by it at the same time.
Tony touched on the bowling alley scene. That was one of the most cringeworthy experiences for me in the show. I mean, there's lots of gory violence, but that, for me, I think is the one that kind of takes the cake. That and the car scene where he's beating up the other dude. His arc for me was weird because there are, and you touched on this, Mike, about the political art, you know, satire element of it. And it kind of reminds me of that, the American who joined up with ISIS. What was his name? John Walker Lind, like all those years ago. He joined up with Al-Qaeda. And that's kind of him. Like, he was this homegrown American born and bred. And then he was like sucked into this terrorist organization, which is basically the same parallel for me. So watching him, that's who I was kind of relating him to, was like this homegrown terrorist, you know, that is very much alive and well. And, you know, the fact that what they were recruiting for, they're getting sort of fresh meat. He's obviously much younger, and, you know, the parallel age to a Jonah in this series, and, you know, the passing of the legacy, passing of the torch, you know, to the next generation. And they're getting these people from native soil. It was a little bit disturbing for me. But in terms of his acting and his ability to carry a scene, I was riveted every time he was on a scene. Like, his voice to me was so chilling. When he was saying the "Are you my mother?" he was reciting that phrase from the book in that bowling alley. And from then on, it was like anytime he was in the scene, I was like, "Oh God, what are you going to do?"
Yeah, chilling, I think, is the right word. He delivers his lines with such cold fury. It's almost like a paralytic when he's talking to you, like the guy in the bowling alley who really couldn't respond. You know, he was paralyzed by fear, by this soft-spoken, conversational malice and menace that he kind of brought to the scene. It is truly, truly disturbing. And I think the idea that people like this exist and you don't necessarily know it. Not again, not to get into spoilers, but, you know, his arc towards the end of the season, like his final action that we really see of him, is just fucking chilling and disturbing and so calculating. He's a villain for all time. Good call, Tony, on that, for sure.
Yeah, and he never raises his voice. He's always even keel, and that's what makes him even more terrorizing, that he never loses his cool. Yeah, and like you said, Mike, and again, no spoilers, at the end, if they made a show just about this character, because you think about all these shows that have come over the years about rooting for the evil character, I mean, he's insane. Definitely polarizing. Like, if you get into his circle, you kind of like, okay, I hate him. He's a horrible human being, but like, I can't stop watching him. What's wrong with me?
Like, there's like 7 or 8 times, you know, when he takes the pizza delivery scene and he's singing songs while he's shooting out the gang on the lawn, kind of thing. Like, it's just so fucking watchable. Like, Lena Gore would be like, well, yeah, Travis. And then you're like, no, you're a bad guy. No, fuck, no, I'm not cheering for you, but I'm digging what you're doing in a very detached kind of way.
Can I talk about the Colonel for a second?
Yes.
Yeah, please. Yes. Let's go.
Lena Olin, like, I don't know. I'm a heterosexual lady, but oh my God, she is beautiful. But that aside, how fucked up is she? For me, her and Jerrica Hinton, who plays Millie Morris, the FBI agent, who I'm sure we'll talk about too. For me, those were two kind of parallel roles. You know, you have the sexual politics that you also have in the 70s, where it's equal rights and women are burning their bras still and things like that. I was questioning from very early on, who is this person and why does she have such a huge role to play in this organization, this underground organization within the United States? Like, who is she? You know, why don't we know anything about her? Like, why don't we know her backstory? Why don't we know what her actual name is? Because, like, her credit is always the Colonel. And she's the lead chess piece when you're looking at the chessboard in the opening credits. It's her up against Meyer Offerman. For me, I was kind of drawn to her initially going, like, why do you have such a powerful role in 1977? Who are you?
Lena is totally sexy. I'm going to back you up on that one, Sheila. She is definitely sexy. And I looked her up because, you know, I didn't know who she was. I just couldn't recall what I've seen her in. And my wife's like, you're insane. You've definitely seen her 100 times. And she was right. So here are the two main characters that are kind of leading in a way, are women. Totally goes against the whole 1977 vibe. And then, again, a little bit of a spoiler here, but there's a lot. There's gay characters. And they're leaders, too. So there was a lot of gay tones throughout the thing, and some of it was thrown out there for jokes and stuff, but then one of them wasn't. You know, it's a really important scene or important role there, and I appreciated it. I loved the fact that, and they touch on it too, when the Colonel's like, oh, you're expecting a man? You know, and I'm not giving anything away because, you know, she's the character on there, and it was just really, really well done.
Sheila actually made a good point about the parallel track. You have Lena Olin with the Colonel, and then you have on, I guess, the good side of the ledger, those words, good guy and bad guy in the show, are a little misleading. You have Millie Morris, played by Jerrica Hinton, and she is an FBI agent who is tasked with looking into a suspicious murder of a NASA scientist. It turns out the NASA scientist is a Nazi in hiding. The question for Millie, and really Millie's journey, which I think is the question that one of the questions as an audience we're also supposed to ask, is righteous killing, justified killing? Is what Meyer and his group, what Meyer and Jonah and their group doing by hunting down and killing in fantastical ways these Nazis, is that justified? Is it righteous? This is something that Millie's character wrestles with the entire series. You know, for her, it's a matter of killing is bad, killing is illegal. I don't care why you're killing. She alternates a lot about whether or not to chase Meyer and his group or not chase Meyer and his group. And it's an interesting discussion. Morally, it's an interesting discussion, but the idea of putting that role in a Black woman in 1977, a woman of authority in the FBI running this case, though, to be fair, she's kind of given the case just to get her out of the hair of her boss. It's really given to her as kind of a throwaway, but she makes the most of it. And she really starts pulling at thread that maybe people don't want her pulling at. But it is an interesting track that you have this other very strong female character running the, you know, running the moral questions on the show. What'd you guys think of Millie and her role as she added to the kind of context of the story?
No, I thought she was solid. She was kind of us investigating along with her, and I thought she was really strong at it. I liked that they threw in her personal life into it as well to help us understand her mindset, you know, with her parents, their partner, and all of that. I thought it was really well done. But yeah, I just got to go back to one thing. Worst nude scene ever? Anybody? The first episode? When he's like, nudity in this episode, I'm like, oh God, it's probably going to be horrible.
Yeah,
things worse
done without that
nude scene ever. And honestly, how is this actress reading the script going, no, I'm in, I'm totally, no, I'm gonna do this, this is a great role for me.
Warning to listeners, don't eat while you're watching the first episode.
Mike, you're being quiet.
I wasn't walking to the bowling alley in a later episode. Stop eating as well.
I mean, I gotta imagine an Amazon paycheck is a pretty good paycheck. I there's probably very few things I wouldn't do on screen for an Amazon paycheck, I think. So.
Wow. But that's, you know, when you get a nudity warning up front, you're like, okay, this may be something. Oh, no, 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 no. But yeah.
You can't unsee what it was just seen. It's there forever. It's blazed on my eyeballs.
Oh, it's in my mind's eye the entire time, Sheila, talking about it. Like, I'm getting a little sick. But that's okay. That's, hey, you know what? More power to you.
This is what makes it prestige TV.
Yes. This is one I won my shutters, by the way. That's when I definitely wanted.
Wait, I heard that you paused it on that, got up, got a sandwich, came back. It was just on there for 20 minutes.
I just want to see who's actually going to call the cops on me first. That's what I'm waiting for.
There's some elder abuse going on in that house.
Oh my God. But I do like Millie's character a lot. I thought she was really interesting.
You guys are kind of pivoting to the next thing that I think we need to talk about is the violence in the show. We've called the show a couple times already very Quentin Tarantino-esque, and it is. It is a pulp grindhouse-style film from the way it's edited with a very tongue-in-cheek introduction of the characters. There's a lot of interesting kind of cutscenes, almost like a comic book feel to it, or maybe even a graphic novel feel to it. The violence is not shied away from. They lean into the violence in a fantastical way that definitely evokes the idea of, you know, from Reservoir Dogs through Pulp Fiction, through Grindhouse, and everything else that Tarantino has really done and made his career on. Definitely inspiring David Wheel and his show here. That's not the major criticism of the show, but one of the criticisms of the show has been the violence is so outlandish as to be detrimental to the show. It takes away from any other kind of message that the show is trying to accomplish. I don't think I agree with that, but I'm curious, did the violence turn you off? Was it too much? You know, on both sides, on the good guy side and the bad guy side, what do you think, Sheila? Was this violence, did it turn you off?
Well, for me, the violence was not over the top in the sense that it was out of context. They're hunting Nazis. There's going to be violence if you're going to be hunting Nazis. And then vice versa. You have the Nazis.
I want to stop. But so I don't think it was the level of violence that people criticized. I think it was the stylistic way in which it was presented. It's that classic thing of you are encouraging this violence by making it look super fucking cool. You know, I think it was the stylistic violence.
Well, I mean, it was also how it was shot. Sort of the violent scenes took a different sort of like editing approach, or the method in which it was filmed or edited would be a distraction. So I think the fact that it flowed with sort of how the scenes were etched together, for me, it wasn't a detractor. Some scenes I would be like, my 6-year-old son would walk in and be like, out, because I just didn't want to see, you know, him to see some of that stuff, just because, it is violent. But at the same time, it was well placed for me. Let's put it that way.
You know, my feeling on that score was, you know, you don't go see a Danny Trejo movie, you know, you don't go see Machete and think that it's going to be about Victorian era poetry. You know what you're getting when you go into it. I think if you did any kind of homework for the show, you should have been prepared for some level of violence. But the question still remains, was it too much? What did you think, Tony?
No, I didn't think it was too much. And by the way, Sheila, you were worried about your 6-year-old walking in. What about the poor guy sitting next to you on the train? Whatever.
It's okay. He's, you know, over the age of, you know, sort of the MA rating. I'd angle my screen away for that, you know, the bowling alley.
That guy had his hand in his pants the entire time, so he has more problems than what Sheila was watching.
He wasn't paying any attention to me.
So the violence, I thought that it was well done. I really do. Because we're going into this show knowing that, first of all, it's around the Holocaust and all the atrocities of it all. So they didn't, we'll talk about that too, I'm sure, I guess too, on how that was portrayed, because there were some people talking about that, whatever, as well. I didn't find the violence to be taken away from the show. I felt that it added, even the way that they shot it, all the vibe to it. And basically, if you're going to watch the show, if you're going to hate watch this show, after the first 5 minutes of the first episode, if you're still locked in, you're not hate watching it. That's ridiculous. You're in. Because as Sheila said it, possibly one of the best openings of all time. It's so violent, so horrendously terrible what happens in those first 5 minutes, that if you're still watching, I don't want to hear you complain.
I think that's a really fair statement to say, that if you can get through that cold opening where it is just horrific violence without context, done in such a stylized kind of way, if you stay on and then, you know, you go through the opening credits with the chess pieces, yeah, I agree with you. I feel like you've kind of bought the bargain here on what kind of show you're getting. Because honestly, that's the kind of violence it is throughout the show. I mean, the characters change, the lighting changes maybe, but the style, the in-your-face stylistic killing remains.
Can I just ask a question? I'm sorry. What does this say about us if the three of us are in total agreement that the first 5 minutes and the bloodbath that ensues is like, yes, this is why I'm hooked on the show?
I think because it speaks to something that you haven't seen before. You know, this is an original idea. This is not based on a book. This is not an adaptation. It's not a reboot. It's an original idea, which right there in modern day television is a godsend. And it's just so fucking in your face. It just grabs you and says, yeah, yeah, that just fucking happened. Sit down, and we have like 10 more hours of that to go.
And I was nodding when you were saying that, by the way, Mike, because it's really great television. All right. So I like the fact that it's an original storyline. Yes, it's got that, you know, that Tarantino influence, but it's an original storyline. To answer Sheila's question, I can watch this show and just love every minute of it. I mean, you guys know that I'm a big fan of Prodigal Son, which is freaking twisted as well. And I watch it every Monday, and I love, love, love that show. But then I'll go and watch Frozen 2. You know what I mean?
Balance.
And love it equally the same. I just love the fact that it's great television and that I get to sit at home and watch it and experience it in my own space and love it and rewind it if I want to watch it one scene again. I don't think the violence really is a deterrent, personally. You're going in watching that show, but knowing that it's going to be that violent. And I'm okay with it.
Tony, you hit on it, and it'll take us to the next part. And it kind of plays into the violence aspect of it, but it really goes very specific to, I think, what ended up being the greatest knock against the show was the idea that the flashback scene. So the show takes place mostly in 1977, but there are several key flashbacks throughout the series to the Auschwitz concentration camps. And it tells the story of Meyer and Jonah's grandmother, Ruth, who is killed at the beginning of the series. Later on, we see the Markowitzes also, their time in the concentration camps. So it tells their story through flashback there. And there are several very disturbing scenes of violence depicted. And a lot of Jewish groups, and namely the Auschwitz Memorial, the Sunday after this released on Friday, Auschwitz Memorial released this following tweet. It said, this was February 23rd. They tweeted, Auschwitz was full of horrible pain and suffering documented in the accounts of survivors. Inventing a fake game of human chess for hunters on Amazon Prime is not only dangerous, foolishness, and caricature, it also welcomes future deniers. We honor the victims by preserving factual accuracy. Now, there's another group called the Holocaust Education Trust that referred to the show generally as being flippant entertainment. The idea here is that the show, by using, again, it's based on true events, but in the show, David Weil created extreme examples of Nazi atrocities within the concentration camps. And he's got a defense, which I'm going to go to in a second. What did you guys think of the way they depicted the Holocaust scenes? They were not factually accurate. That was what the idea that the Auschwitz Memorial is trying to say, is that by giving these exaggerated things, you know, there are so many documented horrors that you could have used in your show that are factual. By using these exaggerated, heightened, you know, atrocities, one, you do a disservice to the people who suffered and died and or survived Auschwitz. And two, you give credence to deniers by saying, look at this propaganda. We didn't play human chess and then shoot people, you know, instead of taking off the board. That didn't happen. And so it gives fuel to the idea that the Holocaust didn't really happen. Look at this depiction of it. Does that hold any weight for you, having watched the series?
I read a couple articles about sort of the criticism of the show, and I saw those criticisms as well. But I was also interested to know why then they did do a chessboard with some horrific violence, you know, of shooting prisoners on it. And for me, the understanding that the creators of the show were intentional in doing something like this because they did not want to draw on real events that would be potentially traumatic then to survivors and their family members, because the survivors now were probably well into their 90s or so at this point. So the fact that they wanted to use fictional events out of respect, for me, made a lot more sense. I didn't know until I did the research that did or did not happen, and some of the other things that happened in the show. So I appreciated the fact that they were careful to sort of preserve and honor the memory of the survivors of Auschwitz by not reenacting something that actually happened.
That tweet I read from the Auschwitz Memorial was on February 23rd at like 7 a.m., a little bit. 5 o'clock that night, Deadline.com ran an article about the controversy, and they had a statement from David Weil. He had prepared a written statement, and they posted it, and I suggest you all go there and check it out. It's actually pretty interesting, and he gives us thinking, and forgive me, I'm going to read a little bit here, but I think getting his take on it, and part of this key, I don't know if it's going to be in the section I'm going to read here, is that his grandmother was a survivor of Auschwitz. He has a very personal connection. He's Jewish, and he has a very personal connection to the concentration camps. So, which I think is important. I mean, we're three goys and girls, you know, sitting here talking about the Holocaust, and so I don't know that we're the best people to talk about it, but I think we could still appreciate the atrocity of it all. But anyway, so this is David. This is part of David Weil's response. Why did I feel the scene was important to script and place in the series? To most powerfully counteract the revisionist narrative that whitewashes Nazi perpetration by showcasing the most extreme and representationally truthful sadism and violence that the Nazis perpetrated against the Jews and other victims. And why did I feel the need to create a fictional event when there were so many real horrors that existed? After all, it's true that Nazis perpetrated widespread and extreme acts of sadism and torture, and even incidents of cruel games against their victims. Well, I simply did not want to depict those specific real acts of trauma. So kind of going to what Sheila said, the idea that he didn't want to tell someone's real story. He talks about how he didn't use any numbers on any of their arms that may have actually existed for a survivor or for a prisoner in a concentration camps. He only used higher numbers because he didn't want to tell anyone's specific story and take the chance of doing a disservice to their memory. So that seems pretty convincing to me. And I think I took it by giving the heightened, you know, the human chess match. I don't think that created caricature. I don't think it took away. I think it hit home the violence, the sadistic nature of the Nazis. I took it kind of how he intended it, I think, but maybe I'm taking it wrong. So Tony, when you hear this story, you hear what the Auschwitz Memorial has to say, and then having watched the show, how do you kind of balance it in your brain?
Again, because you touched on it too, like, you know, here we're three nice little Catholic kids talking about something that I feel like in a way that I shouldn't be talking about because I, you know, none of my family experienced it and all that. But that being said, there's been so many movies and shows done about what happened during the Holocaust. And so the direction that he went, and I appreciate that he wanted to show something that actually, you know, just to make it completely absurd, to go completely how horrible it was, and to make sure that they didn't show anything that could have happened. I applaud that, to just to be like, look, I don't want to show something that's going to trigger. I mean, this is already a trigger enough. But again, then I'm going to take it to the fact that this is based on some, obviously the Holocaust, it was real. Operation Paperclip, which was the highest Google thing that happened that week, I think, because as soon as I typed in Operation, it came up right away into Google because I wanted to see about that as well. I get where they're coming from. I get why they would be upset about it, but I still don't feel as it should be a negative towards the show. Again, this is a bit of fantasy that we're dealing with and based in reality. And so it's going to the extreme.
There's an important part there that you mentioned and that came up from David Weil in his statement. I think to anyone who understands what they're watching, this wasn't meant to be a documentary. This was not meant to be a historically accurate retelling. I don't think he ever said, I don't think Amazon ever promoted it as telling the real story of Operation Paperclip, you know, and Nazi atrocities. I understood it without being told that this was based on true events. I was familiar with Operation Paperclip. I'm familiar with the Holocaust, but I didn't take this as supposed to be gospel. I took this to be a historical fiction based on true events, not true events.
Kind of like, you know, when you're watching The Crown, right? It's not like, oh, this really happened at the palace. It's like there's true events that happened, but this is being, as you said, like it's a drama. It's not a documentary. And so there's things that happen. I like shows that are based in some reality. You know, and then they take it and they go to different directions. And this one did it. And I thought, again, the writing was strong that, again, but I'm not of Jewish descent. I didn't think it was that offensive. So I'll leave it at that.
There's a quote by the famous philosopher George Santayana, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So I think it was important that they brought in the atrocities that happened in Auschwitz, like the flashbacks for me felt real. They felt the flow of the story worked with them. So they wanted to show in the most respectful way possible by, again, not triggering people who were related to people who might have experienced that type of a situation to not have to live it through their loved one's eyes. So I appreciated the fact that they sort of modified the story, but by showing it in such a sort of grandiose way, and there's this chessboard scene that we've talked about, and that's really the scene that got a lot of the controversy. It's important to show how horrible things were, and rather than show scene after scene after scene of these terrible things that happened, they're really just kind of conglomerating it into one really horrific moment that did not happen, so that this way it's out of respect to the people who died at the camp, survived the camp, and were in any way influenced by that time. But also the Steven Spielberg, the USC Shoah Foundation is the one that had the second criticism, Mike, that you read about the show being flippant and not being historically accurate. They were very upset about the scene where we talked about the graphic nudity in the first episode where they said that Jews never gassed Nazis. You know, that's a very big part that they were upset about, saying that we don't want, and this is what I pulled from that article too, is that they do not want to blur the line between victim and perpetrator. So they're very stark on that. I don't feel that there's a line being blurred. I feel that, you know, Meyer Offerman in the very first episode when he meets Jonah for the first time, it's at Safda's Shiva. He says, you know, there's a line from the Talmud he talks about revenge, but he has an amendment to it. He says the best revenge is revenge. And really that's what this is about. This is not a historical documentary. As both of you said, when I looked it up on Amazon, it was under drama, not documentary. You know, so I really feel that this is a historical fiction work. The creators of this were very respectful. I feel that they were intentionally respectful. And the other thing too, I'll just add and throw in, is that the fact that I did watch most of this on the Amazon app on my iPad, there's the X-ray feature, which is terrific. It gives you a lot of context. It gave me some of the Yiddish translations for some of the things. That's a great way to kind of watch it too, to get some context, because they do talk about the fact that the chess scene did not actually happen. It worked for me.
It worked for me too. And I think flat earthers exist. Holocaust deniers exist. People who don't believe in evolution exist. If someone watches this show and watches this violence, watches the chess scene, and if it encourages them to sympathize or empathize with what the Jews went through in the concentration camps and what they survived, what they've been through, I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, we're focusing on the chess match because that's the one that the Auschwitz Memorial talked about. That's, you know, that really drew a lot of ire from people. And it's a really upsetting scene. It's I don't want to downplay it in any way. But there are other scenes that take place in the concentration camps. There's a scene where, you know, Jews get killed because they refuse to stop playing, you know, Halva Negila. There's a scene where Meyer is forced to kill several of his own countrymen over the love of a woman. You know, there are some very emotionally compelling scenes that I don't think in any way make light of or downplay, are meant to leave you with anything else other than this was just the worst possible thing a human being could do to another human being. And that was what I walked away from it.
The series wouldn't have worked, Mike, without the flashbacks. There's no way we would have understood the pain that the Markowitzes felt without the flashback.
All of the journeys, I mean, the Markowitzes' yeah. pain and the choices they have to deal with in the back right. half of the series, the Markowitzes end up getting a great arc, but it comes in the second half of the show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, without the flashbacks, you wouldn't understand it. Without the flashbacks, you wouldn't understand Ruth and Meyer starting right. this band, the arc of, you know, that they call it, which is the room where they have the dossiers on all the Nazis. What would possess someone to do this, to spend this energy, to kill in cold blood? Without the flashbacks, without that foundation of understanding what they have been put through, these are just vigilante assassins, cold-blooded killers. I think with the flashbacks, though, it makes it much more ambiguous. It makes you, you know, think, is this righteous? Maybe it is righteous. Maybe they're right to do what they're doing here. Maybe these Nazis deserve to be brought to justice. I think you're 100% right. Without the flashbacks, you lose a lot of the moral high ground that our good guys are really operating from. We've come to my favorite part of any Love It or Leave It episode. It is time to tell us, do you love it or do you leave it? Sheila, what say you? Do you love Hunters or are you going to leave it?
I absolutely love Hunters. I actually watched it a second time through, and I got so much more out of watching it the second time because, you know, the first time you're literally on the edge of your seat saying, what's going to happen next? I need to know. But when you go back and you kind of digest it a little bit more, you do get a lot more out of it. It's kind of like watching Pulp Fiction for the first time. It's like, whoa, what did I just watch? I mean, you watch it a second time and things start to kind of fall into place. So I also appreciate that kind of like Tarantino-esque part of it. I also think it's very important to tell stories like this because as we are getting on in generations past from the time of the Holocaust, I think having those flashback scenes and, you know, kind of piquing the curiosity of a younger generation going, I need to know more about that. You know, for me, like I had heard about Operation Paperclip, but I did not know the extent of it. So when I finished it, I ran right out the next day to my local library in a very sort of 1980s kind of a throwback to take out the first book that I could find on Operation Paperclip. So I think it's important to tell these stories because also there's parallels to today. You know, you talked about the political satire and the sort of extremism that exists. So in telling these stories, we can draw parallels back to it. But, you know, the show itself is absolutely, for me, I love the characters, the story arcs. Everything was really rich for me.
I agree. So here's another love it vote as well. You know, Sheila, you mentioned, I remember seeing that post about the book, and I love that you did that. It's what I was saying earlier, how I had to immediately Google it. Unlike you, I hadn't heard about Operation Paperclip. I feel that shows like this are really important, especially in today's society where people aren't reading as much. I'm making very blanket statements here, right? But they are, you know, it's not reading as much. And so here comes a show that actually piques people's interest. And so they'll take the effort then to go and learn more about the Holocaust and the atrocities that happened there, to just to learn more what was life like in 1977 America. Because it is interesting the way they show other parts of the country as the series goes on and how that operates. I really appreciated the way that I felt like there wasn't one episode that wasn't worth watching. When you watch a series at times, right, there'll be that like throwaway episode where it's like just to connect to the rest of the show. I felt that that didn't happen here. I felt that every episode was so integral to the storyline. You couldn't miss a minute of it. And whereas like with other shows like Stranger Things, sometimes there's an episode like, I didn't have to watch that one, but not here. Everything was so well connected that I couldn't wait to watch the next episode. So it is definitely a love it. And I would, and I have, I've already told friends, please watch this show. I think it's really, really great, great television. And I'm still going to say that.
I'm just going to jump in for 1 second because with the sort of world that we're living in the last 2 weeks of being home confined and sort of, you know, confined to our quarters here and not really venturing out, a lot of people have been reaching out to me because they know that I write for Pop Culture Review. They're like, do you have TV recommendations for me? And invariably, the first thing out of my mouth has been for the last week, please watch Hunters. It is 10 hours and you'll finish it today. Like, you'll just be done. I think that's a really good love it endorsement.
This show is very well timed. If this is your kind of show, this is very well timed for being in self-isolation. It is a great way to spend 10 hours. It should come as no surprise if you've been listening this far. I also am a love it guy for Hunters. I'm a big fan of the show. It was probably better than I even expected it to be. It is not meant to be Schindler's List. It is a pulpy, gritty, grindhouse genre show. But at the same time, I think it is extremely well written. I think it is extremely well acted. At the same time, it has really top shelf action. It's got fantastical murders and killing and car chase sequences. And it's so many gun bullets and violence and hand-to-hand combat. If that's your thing, this is the show you've been looking for. But it's not all of that. There are as many quiet moments and moments with heart and moments with sincerity. You know, I'm thinking of Carol Kane and Saul Rubinick's characters, the Markowitzes. They have such an emotional journey. I'm thinking of the moments with Al Pacino's Meyer and Logan Lerman's Jonah. Their journey, their quiet moments from their first meeting in Meyer's house, where they have the talk about the best revenge is it revenge or is it living a good life? Their Yoda-Luke relationship, a very father-son kind of relationship that develops, is full of sincerity and heart. Really good quiet moments, really important dialogue that you have to pay attention to, that you have to watch. It has excellent bad guys, which always makes a show more fun. This is a violent show. If you're not into violence, if you can't stomach it, this is not the show for you. But if you're into television that is going to entertain you, it is going to make you sit forward on the edge of your seat with the pedal down on all of the boxes that make great television, I think Hunters is for you. You know, for me, it was a cathartic revenge fantasy, which is great television. I want to see fucking Nazis get killed every 10 minutes. I want to see fucking Nazis being decimated. That shit makes me feel great. I'm fist pumping. Yeah, fucking kill that motherfucker. He deserves to die. Like, cathartic revenge fantasy up the wazoo, and I'm not Jewish, and I still found it just so satisfying. It's a total love it. I think you guys should definitely spend self-isolation by watching Hunters on Amazon. Any final thoughts, Tony? You have anything left to say before we end it tonight?
No, this has been awesome. I've had a really great time. Definitely go check out the show, like Mike said, you know, because, I mean, what other show has a dreamy, hunky Jew? So definitely watch the show.
Yeah, if you've never wanted to bone Josh Radnor, you're going to want to bone him after you watch Hunters. Tony, where can people find you on social media, on the internet, in person, assuming we all make it out of coronavirus and we can go resume our daily lives?
So you can go check out tonycarini.com. That's C-A-R-R-I-N-I. And on there, you'll have where I'm going to be performing again shortly. We're going to be posting some dates in the coming weeks, hopefully. And you'll find me on social media at Tony Carini on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram.
Tony, you got to do some, like, you know, live from your couch comedy shows. You got to jump on this, you know, live broadcasting.
Yeah, I saw what the Jimmies are doing. And so it's so funny you say that. I have literally started writing a show last night, and I'm hoping that we can do it soon. I've been testing
I get a writing credit. No.
I've been testing some green screen apps on my phone because I have a green screen. I use it for work with my Zoom. And so funny you mentioned that, Sheila. You're like the second person today. I'm starting to figure something out because I do want to do something. So look for it.
If nothing else, you should be doing a comedy podcast over with us on Pod Clubhouse. We desperately need some comedy at this point in our lives. You should definitely come join the clubhouse and hang out with us some more.
Sign me up.
We'd love to have you. Sheila, give us your final thoughts and tell people where they can find you on social media.
I think this is a really great way to spend 10 hours of your self-isolation. You know, all the things that you guys have said, it's got the flashy violence, it's got the flashy characters. It has a ton of information that you can then go off and Google to spend some of your time that you need to, you know, decompress your brain from sort of everything that you just saw. I definitely highly endorse everyone, you know, running out to, you know, their Prime and watching this wherever they can, whatever device. And if you can, watch it on the app a little bit, because then you get the little, you know, sort of snippets of the bonus content that they provide. And it does give you a little bit of context. There's a little, you know, segment about Operation Paperclip where they actually interview David Weil, which is very cool. So, you know, that can be sort of like the liner notes or the bonus content for you. You can find me on Twitter. I'm Shields McGangster, and I am on popculturereview.com as well. I write for the website there, and you can find my recaps and my general thoughts on all things pop culture. Thanks for having us.
Tony, Sheila, thank you guys so much for joining us tonight. Everyone, thank you for listening. This has been Love It or Leave It, the podcast talking about Amazon's Hunters. Thank you guys so much, and have a great night. Stay safe out there. Social distance.
Cheers, guys.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.